I need to change the link in my bio from SoundCloud to a GoFundMe for freeing Tyler. I was yelling free my nigga before he was even sentenced, cause a black man in this country come out the pussy, plead guilty, gotta pardon all our problems, a product of police violence, cars crapping, grab your weapon, he'll learn his lesson tonight, cause I'm posted with these disciples and these modern day apostles to pop your ass for the prophet, but the reason Jesus wept is cause one of these.
I seen 100 niggas march and the hoodies black as their skin. It was midnight in Manhattan and rallying had begun. Gunpowder filled the air as the population ran scared. They would never see their city again.
It's 100 niggas with me that ain't scared for dumb. Now these niggas with me, they don't give a fuck. Fuck a rally, we just ride it, trying to tash it up. Native motherfuckers scared my nigga.
Fuck the peace, you gotta keep the peace. With all the hunger and pain in the streets that'll never cease. In the belly of the beast, are you built to survive? So tell me in the end, will you do or die?
Okay, so we're joined with two participants in the social center, The Base, which is located in Brooklyn, New York. Can you all tell us about, first of all, what is The Base and how did it get started? It seems like opening a social center in one of the most heavily gentrified and expensive areas in the country just seems like a huge headache, and I'm just curious kind of what kind of space you were in when you were like, all right, let's really do this thing.
Okay, well, it started around, the idea first came about around the time of Occupy Wall Street, where everyone's going to these big spectacular demonstrations in Manhattan, and then coming back to Brooklyn where most of us live, and there wasn't really much of a, there's no real connection between the street movement and what was going on in the smaller, like, outer boroughs and local neighborhoods. So we figured that it would be cool to have some anarchist infrastructure. And also, there are a lot of, like, there were more leftist projects, but there weren't explicitly any anarchist public spaces for people to go to. So a bunch of us really had the idea to try to really hunker down and try to make something like that happen. Now, it was really complicated because, as you said, it's gentrifying, it's really expensive. So it was, like, a bit of a task to try to raise requisite amounts of money. But then also to find a place that was like pretty cheap for the area. So it was a bit of a, it was a lot of work, but it proved to be pretty fruitful. Anything?
No, that's perfect, good.
Yeah, I guess that's about it.
What was the mindset? You brought up Occupy Wall Street, but just being in that moment and then wanting to switch from that to wanting to have a set space. Like, what was the conversations that people were having that kind of made you want to make that big transition?
Well, one, the people were really excited because there were so many people out, and it was such like an experiment, a social experiment, and like bringing out like consensus kind of politics into the public. But then it was also built out more of a frustration with the whole police have the 99% rhetoric, and there's a really like horrible liberal underbelly to all of it that a lot of us were kind of like disgusted with. So we also wanted to try like push a firmer, a more radical political line. But then you also can't do that in the city without having something really permanent. Like, you can't just squat something because there's like 40,000 police here. So it makes it hard to hold anything down. So we wanted to have something really permanent at the time, and something that could last and hold, build on traditions and whatnot.
Yeah, and at the time, like, a lot of anarchists were meeting, like, in a more underground way and, like, secretive. So it was really hard to, like, make a connection with somebody in the streets or in the park and say, oh, why don't you come back to my apartment? Like, you just couldn't do that, so kind of needed some sort of public interface to be able to bring people into radical politics more.
Yeah, I feel that. Can you just talk a little bit about Occupy Wall Street? There's such, you know, I don't know, a mythology around it, and obviously New York was the epicenter. I mean, not to go off on too big of a tangent, but if you could just kind of encapsulate in a few minutes just your thoughts on it.
Yeah, well, okay, I guess, like, it was the epicenter in that it started it, that it started that kind of movement, but I would personally say Oakland was way more the epicenter for a lot of us. That we're way more excited about Oakland in some ways, just due to the militancy. Like, here, it was really cool because no one expected it to actually, like, last. Everyone kind of, like, thought that, like, oh, people were going to try to occupy Wall Street and just be attacked, and that was going to be the end of it. But the fact that it stuck in the park was really exciting, and it brought out a lot of people. A lot of people around today are still here because of Occupy, so it was really a kind of a big watershed moment for the city. But
yeah, I think that's like kind of the best thing that I see, one of the most long-lasting effects is a lot of people that we know that are active today, like, got politicized through Occupy Wall Street. So it ended up itself being a pretty good interface for people to get more involved in radical politics, and even if they weren't at the time, it ended up being a really good way that for people to enter that dialogue, and a lot of those people still come to the base or participate in projects, so
yeah.
That's really good.
So it's kind of like a blessing and a curse. It was cool because it brought so many people. But then some of the politics were really like apart. They're American flags, and the police are 99% all this foolishness, and you know. So
right.
A lot of people who had that more liberal stuff have kind of fallen by the wayside, which is, I guess, what's to be expected.
Yeah, that's interesting. I assume that, I mean, based on what I've read, it seems like a lot of the, I don't know how you would put it, the cadre of Occupy has kind of like really gotten behind Bernie Sanders, and at this point I don't really know what they're doing now because obviously Sanders' campaign is over.
Yeah.
But, and we'll talk a little bit about Abolition Square in a bit, but can you just tell everybody, because the base, there's so much stuff that comes out of it. It's almost just, it really seems like a really functioning anarchist social center that has like so many programs. You all are doing like, well, I'll let you talk about just the stuff that's going on there, but it's like a lot of community stuff. There's organizing, there's political discussions, there's self-defense training, a lot of infrastructure building and things like that.
So I guess the first thing is that when we started, of course, we wanted people to like be able to become acquainted with radical politics, so we started off with like a lot of reading groups and talks and a radical library and that sort of thing. And then I think through meeting with people and like reading with people and having discussions, then we're able to build up like a team of organizers that we work with now that are involved in a lot of the organizing projects. So for that, like we do like a solidarity network. And it comes back to the gentrification question you brought up earlier, because that's of course one of the biggest problems that we're dealing with right now where we're at. So Solidarity Network is working on that. We're just starting a new project that kind of came out from CopWatch. We had a CopWatch group going out every Saturday, and then we sort of realized it made sense to be a little bit more proactive. So now we're in the process of developing a group of rapid responders for people who just won't call the police, with the idea that it could be expanded to people who don't want to call the police. So right now it's going to be for people who are subjected to ICE raids or victims of hate attacks, or themselves like victims of police violence. And people are getting training like medic training, coming to the fight trainings, learning how to deal with like a mental health crisis, so that they can actually be called out like in the middle of the night if somebody has a situation that they don't want to call 911 for.
So I guess like one of the largest things we're trying to do is to make a public face of anarchism, and that's not at the behest of anything else. It's just that like we feel that like there needs to be like all sorts of things. There needs to be like labor organizing. There needs to be like clandestine things. There needs to be graffiti. There needs to be everything. But we also want to have a face so people could get to meet other people, because it wasn't really easy to do except for in spectacular actions. So now we have a place where like, if someone just like reads the Chomsky book, it's like, oh, maybe I could go find some anarchists, or you know, or if they want to support political prisoners, like Anarchist Black Cross meets every other Tuesday, so you could come and learn about political prisoners and get a meal and you know, and take part in a community that wasn't very public before. It was more of a clandestine community. So
yeah, that's always been a real big problem. Now, you know, a lot of young people I talk to that are interested in starting up a social center, the first thing they ask themselves is, how are we going to pay for it? How does the base function and keep its doors open? Because I'm assuming the rent is probably pretty high there.
Yeah, it's pretty, for New York City, it's actually incredibly low. We kind of got a little lucky finding this place, but the main way we raise is through recurrent donations online. So like people donate about like $10-$20 a month. That's like the main fundraising source we have. And we do like parties and stuff every now and then, but it's mainly the recurring donations that keep it going. We're actually gonna do a fundraising drive for that again soon, just to keep just help us keep the doors open. But it's going really well. We've managed to save up quite a bit, and like we were saying, the rent is it's expensive, but it's low compared to New York prices. So that's the main way. You need to find a base of support and a community of people who are willing to actually all chip in and do something like this. Otherwise, it's not really functional.
And the way it works is like people who have like, you know, better jobs like contribute more, people have like smaller paying jobs will give like 10 to 20 a month. So that way it's just kind of like proportional to like what people are able to give.
Yeah.
Great. And how have some of the projects that have come out of the base, how have those developed? You talked about Cop Watch. I know people were involved in Disarm NYPD. Just kind of curious how all that stuff kind of evolved as the whole Eric Garner situation also took off. It's also really sad to see the guy that filmed Eric Garner's death is actually going to jail, I think, for 4 years now. And I think I don't know if you could just kind of talk about that transition, like once you actually have the space, kind of what that meant to be in the area when something like that kicked off, because I'm sure having that space kind of changed the terrain for you all.
Oh yeah, no, it's really important because like when a lot of this stuff first started happening, like previously, like when I said, people would meet in a park and have this really big open wing-nut clusterfuck of meetings. So since we had the space, we held up a lot of more radical meetings to try like think strategically about how we engage with things and how we can push things in a more militant direction. It's weird because New York is really, in its core, it's, in the outer boroughs, it's a bit conservative, but in the main, like, city area, it's really, like, very liberal, so it's kind of hard for radicals to engage. Whenever we kind of, like, go up and have a militant march, there's always all these peace police and liberals always screaming at us, probably more than a lot of other places. So it gave us, like, a place to sit down and meet and really, strategically think about how to engage with these things. And, like, Disarm kind of came out of that whole thing. Like, a lot of us were thinking that, like, all of us are really into our abolitionists, we all think police and prison should be completely demolished and abolished. But we're thinking that if we push the angle of disarming the police, that's something that's a bit more palatable to larger society.
I just want to say, like, one thing about, like, that whole time period, like, the first, like, Black Lives Matter, like, uprisings in New York, is that we're kind of, like, pleasantly surprised that, like, people who weren't necessarily politicized or politically active, like, kind of outpaced us. So that was probably one of the best things to see, especially after Occupy that had like more kind of like dominant liberal message. So a lot of people were like meeting up and trying to say, okay, well, how are we gonna push these marches? Soon as we hit the streets, like everybody were already like taking bridges and tunnels and highways. So we just kind of fit right into that, which was great. The people were like initiating that on their own. And also like when Disarm was launched, also more mainstream voices started calling for police abolition. So that was actually, I think, probably a great indicator that people are ready for something a little bit more, is that we got outpaced immediately.
What do you all think of that? Because obviously there's more and more talk about abolition now. How do you feel, like, what's the, how do I put this, like, what should the anarchist position be in a time when, you know, part of the left is actually picking up that banner?
Well, I guess, like, it's kind of strange because you see a lot of mainstream voices talking about abolition, but they're not talking about dismantling the state. So they'll talk about, like, abolishing the police department, but funneling that money into other state resources. So I think that's kind of, like, the key way that anarchists can be involved then, is, like, talk about that as connected to the state and how to dismantle the entire thing. And with the base and the kind of organizing projects that we've been doing, we've been trying to really brainstorm and think about how we can build up the resources necessary to have these kind of like modes of operation outside like the state infrastructure. So if we can build up something like the Rapid Responders or some other community groups, people could actually see a way out of that dynamic.
Yeah. I also think that's kind of, in some ways, not to be too self-congratulatory, that we should applaud ourselves for at least getting these messages out. It's like, we pushed things for so long, so often, and it's rare that you actually see it, like, building with fruition and coming to, you know, coming to being. It's cool that, like, these more liberal people are finally starting to really grapple with these ideas that people like Angela Davis and others have been pushing for so long. So it's really good. I'm happy about it.
Can you all just describe, I mean, for people that are listening that have never been to New York, just kind of, as you said, there's a lot of police there, and sometimes, for me, you know, I've been there several times, but it just seems, at times, very hard to imagine, like, a popular kind of uprising, people in the streets, just because there's so many cops, and just the geography of the city, and, I mean, if I don't know if you could kind of speak to that.
Yeah, well, it's tricky, because it's like, that's why something like Occupy or like the Black Lives Matter movement is so rare, because like, one, a lot of times the police in the city are scared of things going too far, so they give a certain bit of leeway. There's other times like with Occupy where it's like you push it and push it and they get kind of nervous, which is kind of awesome. But like, yeah, I guess it's hard for people to imagine, but it's like, all right, there's about 8 million people here, 8 to 9 million in the city proper. If you look at the outer boroughs, it's probably about 15, 16 million people. But then in the city itself, there's about 40,000, maybe 36 or 38,000 cops, which means you can't really go outside without seeing police. So anytime you leave, you'll see at least 5 or 6 cops, maybe just going to get like a candy bar or something. So it's the, if you're actually trying to do more militant things, it's really complicated because you're constantly dealing with police repression. And then there are cameras every single way you look. It's hard not to be on camera somewhere. And then a lot of activist groups, for instance, have actually normalized this idea of like filming themselves and filming everything. So it kind of like, it really cripples you from doing a lot of things you might want to do just because you're always being filmed. So it's like, it makes the terrain really complicated. So, you know, like in other cities, like in Oakland or maybe in like, I don't know, some places in the Midwest, it's like there are different struggles, but here it's like really, that's one of the main things we're up against. So,
just to get back to the base, how do you all deal with just the massive amount of work that goes into all this stuff and then also having to work so much and keep the doors open? How do you organizationally answer those questions of dealing with burnout? Because you all do a lot, you know, you're doing a lot of organizing projects, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the base. Kind of curious how you actually make that all work.
Well, there's a bunch of people that do different things, and each project kind of functions in like a decentralized manner. So like, for instance, like Erica's Black Cross is like its own thing. There's a small collective that they do that work, and that's their thing. People come in supportive roles, people come to dinners and sign letters and cards and stuff. But then you have a group like Brooklyn Sire Network, which is also its own thing. So one of the things we tried to push with the space is that each project has the autonomy to do whatever it wants without the other groups intervening in their processes. So once you have a project there, it's just kind of like its own thing. You get the keys to the space, you do what you want, and you don't have to really worry about something else. So there's like a bunch of projects. Like we have Mutual Aid Self-Therapy, that's its own collective. You have Brooklyn Solidarity, we have like Rojava Solidarity. Each of these things is its own functioning thing. So it's still like, once again, it's like there's different, sometimes there's one person who's in a few of these collectives and it kind of burns you out a bit, but they're large enough so it's not all necessarily on one person. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's great.
Yep.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the gentrification going on in New York. Can you kind of describe it? I know you all have been organizing against a new condo development. Just what does the terrain look like? How is gentrification in Brooklyn and New York kind of taken shape over the last couple of years? And what's the response been, not only from anarchists, but also other social antagonists?
Yeah, well, it's really a very all-encompassing kind of problem. It's the scale of it is kind of hard to describe without seeing it, and that like it's happening pretty much in every single borough, and in each borough it's really very quick and very violent and very large process. So it's unfortunately the radical response to it isn't very as it's not as large as you'd want it to be, but it's also because of a capacity problem. There aren't that many radicals in New York City, and then there's a really strong liberal current. So anytime you do try to organize something against like say development or against some kind of like horrendous landlords, there are always these like liberals that come out and like, oh, you don't represent the community, you're not from the community. Even if you're from New York or from the very same neighborhood, they tell you you're not from the community. So it's like you're always kind of like up against this like really swift, like counter-insurgent kind of process that's trying to stop you from taking it to a different degree. But there are like these developments that come up are really huge. They completely destroy Williamsburg, for instance, used to be kind of like an industrial kind of area. Now it's just like one of the richest places in the world. That's happening in Bushwick right now, and it's really mammoth. It's really kind of like violent. Like they built this huge construction called the Colony. They named it the Colony and have this whole language of colonialism on the project to kind of like mock the local neighborhood.
There's
years ago in Bushwick, there's the government, the city passed this project called the Bushwick Initiative, where they were going blocks to blocks rounding up young people with these drug raids, and they locked up hundreds of people, and were pretty much just clearing the streets so they could, like, usher in these new, this new process of gentrification.
Like, when we first started the base, it's, in Bushwick, and a lot of the people we met initially, aren't around anymore, because they've all been, like, swept up in these dragnets and shipped upstate. So it's a really strange process, because, like, you can literally see how they're clearing the neighborhood, and at the same time, you have people getting out who were swept up in the 90s, and they don't even recognize the neighborhood. They're like, oh, I used to be here, my friends used to be here, I can't even, like, recognize the landmarks, because there's new buildings that have gone up.
Yeah.
But that was a kind of violent process. We witnessed a little bit of that, like, the tail end of that. But then what we were dealing with B-Solid, like, initially, was landlords that had initially taken in, like, Section 8 tenants or more, like, low-rent-paying tenants. And when they saw the opportunity they could be having, they tried to resort to underhanded methods to push their tenants out. So a lot of the initial B-Solid work was to help people, like, individual, like, tenants fight their landlords, because they would never win in court, of course. And that ended up being very successful. But of course, we started realizing that it's a very piecemeal solution. Like, you can help, like, individual tenants, but then if you don't deal with the overriding gentrification problem, you really are just going to keep doing the same thing. So after, you know, there's the Colony, there's another, like, very offensive, like, condos that have gone up. The new one that Brooklyn Solidarity Network has been fighting, it's at this old Reinhold Brewery. Basically, they took over this kind of light industrial area, and they made, like, a very massive condo development. There's two parts of it, like, a couple different developers, because it's so massive. But one of them is literally called the European Village.
We should talk about like that one thing, though. It is actually built yet. They're in the process of constructing it. We've been trying to get the construction halt.
So that was kind of
the European Village. Was the plantation taken?
Exactly. That's horrible.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then, like, from being around town, knowing people, we started hearing that, like, local real estate agents were referring to this particular development as the game changer. So,
oh,
like,
shit.
Everyone, like, in the industry kind of saw this as, like, ground zero gentrification game.
Yeah. Just to give you a size of a scale of it too, it's probably it's about like 6 blocks. It's they're shooting for about 3,000 or 4,000 units in this whole development, which is about like 7,000-8,000 new residents at least. And if you know, if you drop that many rich people in one neighborhood, it's like completely changed, definitely. So, and the scope of the architecture is crazy, where they have like these sloped roofs, where they have like all this gardening and pools and all this really like gratuitous wealthy crap.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I think a lot of New York anarchy, I think a lot about, you know, like riots in the Lower East Side, the shadow squats in like the late 80s, the book The War in the Neighborhood, which all deals with gentrification. I'm curious, like, is that generation still kind of around in New York, or they've all been pushed out? Like,
there's
are you...
people from that period that are still around. A lot of them aren't around, but there's certain people like Scott Frank Morales and a bunch of other people. They're still around, but they're kind of getting older. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're not as active anymore. They give like talks, and sometimes they like they try to explain what it was like back in the 80s to a lot of the younger people coming up. But yeah, they're still around, some of them. A lot of them are kind of falling by the wayside.
And it's definitely useful for us to talk with them, because they kind of know the terrain. And then, but of course, with the Lower East Side struggle, it happened much more slowly, and there was much more groundswell of support, you know? Like, now I think they have, like, the gentrification process is, like, down to a science, so it's, like, super quick and super brutal. So it's a slightly different, like, beast that we're dealing with, but being able to, like, get advice from them has been really useful.
Yeah, and the liberal reformist people in the city, I would say, are probably just as destructive as the developers, because anytime you start talking to people and people start getting active, they come in and try their best to funnel it all into these weird Democratic Party outlets. That's it's really insidious and really very frustrating. So that's like one of the worst things about the city too.
And like some of the I guess you use the term boroughs, but like Williamsburg is like one of the most notorious like hipster enclaves and stuff like that. Like, does that changing of the neighborhood, does that make it hard to build like a base for anarchist activity, because you just kind of have people that are kind of coming in because it's hip, they might be there for a couple years and then they'll fade out. So it seems like it would be difficult to try to like really build some ties with people that are living there. that are connected to the neighborhood if it's constantly in flux like that.
It's definitely like, that's what's weird about like, say, a place like Williamsburg, and that like it has some reputation for like a hipster enclave with all these like young people. But it's not really like that anymore. It's just like real estate people and like finding like all these people who work on Wall Street. It's not even like young people anymore. It's just like really the ultra rich who are there. So it's like the more than like young people have been pushed further out to Bushwick. But that's actually, this is something we're doing a little different. That's not actually like what we usually organize with anymore. I think like a few years ago, anarchists were kind of like focused on organizing with more young people, and I think we're kind of just really getting more of a neighborhood-rooted thing where we have like a lot of people who've just like been here forever who are kind of coming around more, which is kind of cool. But once again, that's also hard too because those are people who are usually pushed out quick, so it makes it really complicated.
See my whole life flashing right before me. Free my homie, yeah, my nigga, he dying slowly. 25 to life, dying slowly. Come and save my homie. Come and save my homie. Just come inside, just come inside, just come inside, my homie. Come and save my brody. Come and save my brody. Come and save my nigga. Fuck 12, my nigga.
Been the response from people in the neighborhood when they encounter the base? Because from the pictures I've seen, there's like a black flag on the window with a circle A, and you know, it's very upfront that it is anarchist. Is there kind of like oh boy, I don't know about this, or is it just a learning experience, or what's people's reaction been to the base?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not really people either. A lot of people are kind of like, most people know what anarchism is, so like they're not like. Random people are just like, no, I hate this. They're just like, I don't even know what the hell this is. So it's like most of the time when you get to meet people, it's more of like we don't really bombard them heavily with political stuff as opposed to getting to know people. They're people who have an opinion of anarchism are either really excited or really hostile. So it's like, you know, most regular people who come don't really have an opinion. So they're kind of just like hearing out what we're doing. And, you know, I think most people are kind of supportive of it because, like, when you tell people like you're supporting political prisoners or you're trying to help people stay in their apartment, stuff like that, nobody's really that outright hostile to it. And if you get to the more nitty gritty, then it's getting a bit more complicated, but it's like a process.
I mean, like, you know, a lot of our neighbors we've known for a long time maybe don't know that that's our spot when they find out. They're like, wait, I saw this like poster that says that disarm the NYPD on there. Let's talk about this. So it's actually cool to have the relationship first and then be able to discuss the politics.
Yeah, exactly. Some people are like, you know, I think disarm the NYPD sounds crazy, but they know, they already know us, so they don't like think we're crazy. They're just like, you know, that sounds like a wild idea. But they, when they see us, they associate us with like just being regular nice people, so it's not that complicated.
How would you describe like the situation with Eric Garner, did that change things to a great degree in New York? Do you feel like with most people, was that like a watershed moment in just the way that people viewed the police?
Maybe in some ways it seemed like it would be, and I think it riled people up. People got really upset about it, but it's kind of like, it's weird because it's kind of like the status quo in New York, I guess, America at large. Now, like, people probably don't know about Akai Gurley's case as much, but that in some ways was, if not equally, it was, may have been even more heinous, but it was, he's a this young dude who lived in the Pink Houses, which is a project in Brooklyn, and, he was going out for a date with his girlfriend, and, officer shot him dead in the stairwell of his apartment for no reason, just because he was scared because there was a black person walking in a hallway and he killed him. And this, well, this cop was actually convicted, but was just released. He was convicted of manslaughter, I think it was, and he was just, they gave him no prison time. He got a year or two of probation and that was it. And that's, I think, it's equally as heinous, but it also shows how, like, people are kind of, like, numb to it to some degree. So when it blows up, it really blows up. Now, like, for New York, it was kind of like, both of them were kind of, like, watershed in that it showed how horrendous NYPD is. But I think people are also kind of, like, normalized to the brutality, which is a bit unfortunate.
I think maybe, like, the demonstrations had more of an effect that you're talking about, because with such an uprising or such, like, a kind of virulence of emotion and the uprising, then I think it became a little bit more commonplace to talk about this problem that everyone sort of already knew about, you know? So I think that, yeah, but that's a good thing. That shows, like, the usefulness of, like, protests. And you can still see it, too. Like, people still see that that's a problem and needs a solution and don't have any answer for it. So I think that's a really important place for anarchists to fit into.
Yeah. I think black people in general, especially in New York and elsewhere, are looking for a very more militant, radical answer to these things, because I think people generally know that, like, this, I mean, it's the same kind of problem that's been going on since before the Civil War, and it really isn't going to resolve itself until we resolve it, I guess, more militant action.
Let's go back to that issue you brought up about just kind of, I don't know how you describe it, kind of like burnout or just like a feeling of numbness to all these police killings. I was talking to somebody the other day. They had just gone to Greece, and people in Greece were just kind of flabbergasted that American police can kill 3 people a day in America and there's just not massive rioting. And, you know, obviously sometimes there is, but I'm just curious, like, what you think of this situation where we're in like a constant state of police murders to a high degree, but only in some cases it kind of pops off, and kind of why do you think that is? You brought up the Gurley case, and I know that you all put a lot of work into that, and I don't know if you just had any thoughts about kind of like how people should engage when these things do happen in their areas.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel that, like, although one reason, I mean, I don't know how to put this, that I feel like we don't have the requisite organization to push things in a better direction yet. I think it's developing. I think that the discourse that we're all using is getting way better, and that our views are getting out there, which is way better. But, like, it was something like the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, that kind of, like, had a requisite response to what was going on. I don't think we've just gotten there yet. And that's not to, like, not, like, revolutionaries in the country. I think things are building in a good direction. I just think that, like, eventually, when there's a more militant, organized response, that people from who are really the victims of this kind of thing will respond in kind. I think it's developing. I think it's going to develop in a better way than the Panthers versus it was so hardcore and authoritarian. I think that, like, our politics are getting out there better. Especially, you can see all around the world, that's, like, something that's, like, really inspiring about Rojava, in that, like, they start off with having this really strict authoritarian Maoist communist model, and everyone saw how that's, like, really antiquated and it doesn't really work. And they start looking at this, like, American anarchists, and they're trying to implement this into all their, like, social organization, which I think is something that, like, we need to think about here. And also, like, one other important thing about the current struggle for here is that there's a specific ethnic minority that was oppressed for so long, which is very similar to here, right? The black population has been beaten down for so long. And if these people can start organizing in a similar degree, I think it could, you know, bring liberatory potential for everybody. Maybe a bit off the cuff.
Okay, we'll come to the Rojava question in a second, but I'm curious. Oh, were you going to say something else? Go ahead.
No, I realized I went off on a tangent about
No, that was great. Yeah, we'll come back to Rojava in a second, but I was curious if you could talk about Abolition Square and just kind of how that all played out, because that seems to be a little bit about what we're talking about, too.
Yeah, that was a really exciting moment, because all of a sudden there were so many groups that wanted to advocate for police abolition. I guess like they planned out an occupation right from the start. So thinking of Occupy Wall Street as a model, and they were able to sort of like build up the infrastructure before it started, which is a little bit different than Occupy Wall Street that hit and then everyone scrambled to like supply the infrastructure. So they basically planned out to have the occupation of a park until three demands were met. One that Bill Bratton, the police commissioner, resigned. Two, reparations for families who had been shot by the police or killed.
And then broken windows police.
But then all of those things kind of like underlined with the idea that we're fighting towards police abolition. The crazy thing about that was the second day after it existed, Bill Bratton did resign. So that was kind of amazing. Kind of like gave it like a burst of energy or a burst of like a feeling of success. In the end, they didn't really get the reparations addressed or like that. But I think there's a couple things. Like I think it was really, really positive that rhetoric got out there for abolition. And the other thing is that like having something a little bit more high profile like that, like they had a lot of like press involved, really helped kind of push that out to like other parts of the country.
And the cool thing about those guys, I guess, is that like it's New York City shut it down for millions of march. A lot of these people, they're out there having like marches every like week practically, which that's like kind of like their thing. They do it all the time, and it's cool that they like try different tactics.
This is the People's Monday thing.
Exactly.
Since the Black Lives Matter movement like popped off in New York, they've been having every Monday night they have a march for somebody who's been shot by police. So they've been able to kind of maintain this like culture of like street demonstrations very consistently, which is really good.
Yeah, I watch it on Twitter. It's pretty amazing that they continue to have such a large presence out there. It's pretty inspiring. Did a lot of people come out to that? It was just really cool to see that happening along with Freedom Square in Chicago and also the Decolonize LA in Los Angeles. So it was just really interesting to see kind of that potential for like police-free zones, you know, abolition zones kind of take shape.
Yeah, at its peak it was a few hundred, I would say. Once again, it was hard for everyone to occupy indefinitely. That was the difference about occupying this in a way, is that like this was almost exclusively radicals who were engaging with it, and we won't have the largest numbers in New York City. So it's like hard for people to come all the time because we all have like jobs, we have to like keep our apartments going, we have a project we're doing. So it's a little harder for us to do that. Occupy Wall Street was so large that it was good that it was large so people stayed there, but then it was like all the people who stayed didn't really have radical politics. So it's kind of like, you know, that traditionally too. Save all these liberals and Rob Paul supporters running around. And a lot of us had to go to work. So,
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
you can see too, I mean, that kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier about like kind of building up like consistent, permanent, or like long-term infrastructures that, you know, it was really exciting to see that so many groups were into police abolition. But I also think like that message maybe didn't reach so far like in the broader public. So that's might be one of the reasons why didn't have so many people to occupy Wall Street. So I feel like that's a little bit of a challenge for us, is to keep building up those alternatives or other ways of doing things so people see this as a realistic option and not like a pie-in-the-sky thing that some activists are doing.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the Rojava question. Just you all have been doing a lot of stuff around that, or just kind of constantly been putting that in your thoughts and posters and stuff like that. Can you just talk a little bit about what people have been doing to support the revolution going on in Rojava and why you find it to be important and how you kind of include that in the work that you all are doing?
Yeah, we've been looking really closely at how they organize, how they've been able to implement a ground-up organizational structure. projects we've been doing as a way of putting people back in charge of their lives or being able to make those key decisions about how resources are used and that sort of thing. So that's been very useful for very, very pragmatic decisions. There's also a group at the base called Rojava Solidarity NYC that's been spearheading a lot of the solidarity work. So, like, on one hand, trying to help people there get resources, and then on the other, kind of spread the ideas of the revolutionary model or talk about what's going on to people here who don't know about it. Since, of course, in the mainstream press, it's covered in a very, very specific way that kind of excludes the anarchist angle.
Yeah. So we sent, like, tons of books there. People, they have a women's center called the Ishtar Women's Center in Rojava that was almost ravaged by ISIS. I guess a lot of people involved with it were killed from ISIS. And so people sent out some funds to try to help them get back on their feet. And they do, like, a lot of, like, they do feminist stuff and a lot of things for women's groups and whatnot. So those are two of the things that we've done so far. And a lot of it's been educational to try to educate people on what's going on there. And I mean, a lot of us, we think it's kind of one of the most important moments in anarchist history, probably since May. So, we think that, it has to be supported. We're trying to, like, learn a lot from what they're doing. There's also one thing a lot of people probably don't know, is that there's international battalions, some that are modeled off the Spanish Civil War, of, like, anarchists and communists, that are there fighting alongside the YPG, which I find one of the most enthralling things I could imagine ever see since I've gotten involved in anarchism.
And then, of course, recently, there's a young anarchist from Colorado that died in one of the battles in Rojava. So Rojava Solidarity NYC made kind of a send-off video for him.
Yeah. It's going down. Got some messages for some people that knew him, and they were very, very, very moved by that. And they said that they showed it to his parents and his family, and they really liked it too, and they were very much in support of the video, and they really liked it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because the person that sent us that message, I apparently is involved in the Standing Rock encampment, so just kind of this kind of circuit, you know, very, very grief circumstances, but very inspiring that, you know, all those things are ultimately connected, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, all that stuff is really big. Like, I don't know if you guys, people are familiar with Paul Simons, but he was someone who went to Rojava too. Yeah, he was saying that he was talking to some of the Yipuk commanders and whatnot, and they were really intricately studying the Spanish Civil War and mistakes that were made. And so it's like, it all kind of comes full circle, like indigenous struggles here, the Black Liberation struggle here. You see YPG part of the Black Lives Matter signs, it's all kind of like, it's all interconnected. People need to make that more pronounced.
Oh, and I can also mention too that a youth group from Rojava recently got in touch with Rojava Solidarity New York City, and they asked to be put in touch with anarchist and socialist youth groups in the States. So if anybody has connections to those, then definitely get in touch, because it's wonderful to make those connections.
Yeah, that sounds really great. We can talk more about that. Well, just a couple questions left, and we'll let you go. But what do you think if there was more kind of social centers like the base that kind of came out in the area? How would those work together? Do you feel like that would kind of help spread the work or kind of push things forward, or what would that look like if there was more projects like the base that did exist in different neighborhoods?
Oh, that would be great. That's the ideal situation. Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, it's a little complicated because, of course, there's, like, so many people that, like, fund one thing, but if we're successful, then we can get more people who are interested in these ideas and want to push them and commit themselves to it. The bigger it grows, the more we should have, the better it could be. Federated social centers would be ideal.
Yeah, exactly. And isn't there something going on in the Bronx that's kind of similar?
Yeah, there's a Bronx Social Center that's new. It's I think it started about a year ago, something about that. It's definitely a cool project, exciting project.
And they face some of the same challenges that we faced out here in Bushwick. So they're just starting their gentrification process up in the Bronx, and a lot of kids are getting swept up in these kind of, like, arrest operations to clear the way for developers. So they're kind of, interestingly, like able to get in on that struggle on the ground floor, whereas we kind of came in like after it was almost completed. Hmm. So hopefully they'll have a little bit more success being able to battle it as it's happening.
Gotcha. And let's kind of close with kind of a big organizational question. You know, we've kind of talked about this on our own, but you know, we kind of touched on it, but how would you see anarchists in the U.S. kind of pushing forward more, either organizationally or just tactically, or just building more of a base of support for their ideas, or all those things at once? Like you kind of mentioned that things are going in a better direction, but why do you think that is, and how would they continue to do so, and kind of what hurdles do we kind of need to overcome to get there?
Yeah, well, I think that there's one big hurdle that we've had in the past few years is that people kind of push specific tactics with specific organizational forms and get hunkered down in that, where it's like labor people have to only pick it and do this, insurrectionists only attack. Well, it's like we really need a more mature, coordinated way of looking at these things, where like they can all work in tandem to larger goals. So I think that like what I'd like to see happen is that we can lay out some really basic, pragmatic like goals we're trying to achieve, and then maybe all work in tandem towards these larger things. Like, I mean, this is a little abstract still, but like for like say like black liberation, you know, property issues and other things, we can all just work towards that with, you know, either attacking or organizing like on a local level, and so we can all work in tandem. Now, I'm not exactly sure how that would all come together, and I would like to have larger discussions about it, but I think we need some kind of more pronounced organizational form so people can understand what we're doing. Because if it's just like, you know, we go to these one-off demos and we try to push things into a larger like riot or wild out, that's good and all, and it's great, and it should always be encouraged, but it probably just shouldn't be at the behest of everything. It should all work in tandem together, I think. That's something I'd like to see, at least.
That's perfect.
If that makes some kind of sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other day I was at the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Conference, and it was really interesting to meet a wide variety of people from kind of like different perspectives, kind of all working on the same thing. And I mean, it feels like the stakes are higher right now, and people need to kind of grow up and stop being set in an ideological niche of just they can only do one thing, you know, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I feel like nobody actually knows. It's not like anyone has a specific blueprint to revolution. So it's like if we could all kind of just agree that we don't have the set answers and try to work in tandem together, it might get things to be pushed in further in the right direction.
Yeah, we had this really wonderful talk by a woman who's heavily involved in indigenous struggles out in Mexico at the base. And I asked her about that. I said, well, what do you do? People are scared about repression, or they're hesitant to get involved for a variety of reasons. And then she said, well, there's always a role for a person to play. Like, if they believe in the struggle and they agree with you, there's always something they can do. So we've been trying to kind of think along those lines too. It's like there's different levels of involvement, and as long as you're all kind of like focused on that kind of liberatory struggle, then you can be involved.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to say? Any shout outs? And maybe tell people how they can make a monthly donation to the base so they can keep it open?
Okay, yeah. If you look at our website on the basebk.org, there's a donate button. And it's really easily laid out. You just click on it. There's a bunch of links for $10, $20 donations. And people think sometimes that like these small things don't matter, but the $10, $20 donations is really what keeps the space going. It's not like the biggest donors that do it. It's a series of small ones that really keep it going well. So please do it if you have the capacity to. And also, if you have any kind of capacity, you definitely donate to itsgoingdown.org, which is like a fundraising drive. You can also use the funds.
Oh, I have one more too. If you're a student and you're based in New York, there's a new group starting, Revolutionary Student Action Network, based out of CUNY. So they're a really great group to get involved with.
Okay, and thanks a lot, and it's just amazing to see all the stuff that you all have going on there, and hopefully people listening to this will get inspired. Check out the website. You all are also on Twitter as the base, also on Facebook, so you can connect through social media. And thanks a lot, y'all, and we'll talk to you soon.
You know it.
Thank you so much.
the middle fingers high in the sky. To the punk ass cop backstage. Yo, Dre.
What up?
I got something to say.
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they had the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one. For a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe to toe in the middle of a cell.
All right, everybody made it all the way to the end. Thanks a lot for the bass for joining us. Again, you can check them out online. Check Twitter, Facebook, and their website for more information about how to support them. And for more information on how to support us, please go to itsgoingdown.org. Check out IGD_news on Twitter. Check our Facebook at It's Going Down. Please, if you can, if you got a couple bucks, if you like what we do, if you like these podcasts, if you like the site, if you like everything that we got going on, please sign up every month. Become a subscriber, become a sustainer, give us something, give us 5, 10, 20 bucks. It really helps keep us going. All the donations that we've got so far in the last month have been great. We really need to make a couple hundred bucks every month to make this project sustainable. So if you like what you see, if you like what you hear, please support us. Sign up, go to the website, click donate. You can sign up to every month, have a little bit come out of your account. It doesn't have to be a lot. Every little bit helps, please. Help support us, help sustain us, help keep us going, because there's a lot more coming.